You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
During her last year of law school, Mahvish Rukhsana Khan grew concerned about just how few legal rights the detainees at Guantanamo Bay seemed to have. Ms. Khan was fluent in Pashto. Her parents were Afghan immigrants who'd settled in Michigan, so she volunteered to become an interpreter for habeas lawyers working at the prison. And she writes about the strong bonds she developed with several so-called enemy combatants who eventually won release in My Guantanamo Diary, which is published by Public Affairs. I'm very pleased that it brings Mahvish Rukhsana Khan to the show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, what inspired you to leave what must have been a fairly comfortable life as a law student to work with people who'd been branded the worst of the worst terrorists?
I was studying Guantanamo Bay in my international law class in law school.
They're teaching Guantanamo Bay now in law schools?
Yeah, we were studying the cases that had gone up to the Supreme Court, and I just remember feeling outraged that these men were being rounded up and hidden without ever being charged or given trials, and the rights that any alleged rapist or murderer in America would have. And that was initially what spurred my interest in getting involved.
Had you always intended to use your law degree to do public service work?
I definitely hope to help individuals who didn't have a voice.
Didn't you use Google to find habeas lawyers working at Guantanamo?
I did. While I was in...
I wonder what would have happened 30 years ago if something like this had popped up.
It would have been more difficult. I Googled the cases that I was studying and found who the attorneys were that had taken it up to the Supreme Court and got in touch with their offices and volunteered to get involved as a Pashto interpreter because I grew up in an Afghan household where we spoke Pashto. And that is, I offered my linguistic skills because there were no other Pashto interpreters who had security clearance, and therefore the Afghan detainees were not able to meet their attorneys and converse with them. So that was my foot in the door with Guantanamo.
Was that difficult to get that government clearance?
It took 6 months of FBI background checks, and they interviewed everybody from my neighbors to my teachers, landlords. They pulled my transcripts and my credit history and asked all sorts of questions, but eventually I did get it.
Because access to the prison by non-military personnel had been pretty limited at that point.
That's right. Until 2004, attorneys and their interpreters were not allowed at Guantanamo, but after that, it involved these background checks, and based on the results of those, they were.
Whether you believed in habeas corpus rights or not, you must have been a little apprehensive about meeting some of these people because they had been branded the worst of the worst.
Definitely. My initial involvement had to do with the legal principles that I was studying as a law student. And once I got to the base, the purpose shifted for me, but I remember on my first base trip, I was nervous because I was nervous about meeting somebody who was famously called the worst of the worst. And I was scared of meeting somebody who was Taliban or Al-Qaeda, somebody who might not want to sit down next to me because I was a woman. And I remember walking into that first meeting room, meeting prisoner number 1154, and he was shackled to the floor. And I walked in, I'd covered my hair because I didn't know how conservative he would be. And he smiled, and I gave him the universal Islamic greeting, which translates to "May peace be upon you," and shook hands with my first terrorist, and learned later that this man was really named Dr. Ali Shah. He was a pediatrician. He'd worked for the United Nations, and he was a Shiite Muslim and who were a persecuted minority by the Taliban, and had a wife who was an economist. And there he was being accused of being Taliban, and it just didn't make any sense.
And you say he reminded you a bit of your father.
He did. He was extremely just polite and articulate and so hospitable. He, despite all of the abuse that he had suffered, and he had a lot, he tried to remain dignified and was hanging on to his pride. And it reminded me of any member of my family.
How long had he been at Guantanamo before you met him?
Approximately 3 years.
Wow, because his case seems kind of clearly a situation of where he really should not have been imprisoned. He'd only returned to Afghanistan to start a medical clinic 2 days before he was arrested. He'd been in hiding in Iran, hadn't he?
That's correct. Because he was a persecuted minority and he had three young kids, including a little girl, and his wife was an economist, he didn't want his family to be raised under the Taliban. So he was left to neighboring Iran as a refugee to flee their oppressive rule and only returned after they were toppled to work for the UN and to open up these health clinics and to serve his people. And he was picked up only 2 days afterwards.
Turned in for reward money?
It's speculated because he came from a prominent Gardez Afghanistan family and he wanted to run for parliament. And it's speculated that, you know, he could have had political opponents. And what a lot of Americans do not know and are unaware about is that the U.S. military airdropped thousands of these leaflets offering up to $25,000 in bounty money for Taliban and al-Qaeda. And when you offer that kind of money to an individual in Afghanistan, it's like winning the Super Lotto jackpot, because in Afghanistan, the average Afghan makes about 80 cents a day, which is $300 a year. And it's a lawless country where religious, political, ethnic feuds go back for generations. And this created this huge financial incentive for locals to turn one another in. And the fundamental flaw is that the U.S. military did not investigate any of the allegations made by locals who had this incentive to gain.
Well, did the United States have any way of ascertaining whether there was probable cause to keep these people in prison?
The United States did not hold Article 5 Geneva Conventions hearings, which they have historically done in both Vietnam and Gulf War I, and not having these hearings and not having an investigation is what led to so many mistakes, because...
Well, who made the decision not to have the hearings? Is this one of those things where John Woo handed... Is it John Woo? John Yoo?
John Yoo. I think It was pre-John Yoo, but it was, a decision made by within the Department of Defense not to hold these terror suspects. And I believe this happened at a time when fear and anger post 9/11 was at its peak, because I don't believe the U.S. military did this maliciously to round up individuals. But
didn't you meet one man who had been picked up because he wore a Casio watch?
Yes.
That's because they're like the watches that are sometimes used by al-Qaeda members to detonate explosives. But there are a lot of people in the world with Casio watches.
Including some of the guards at Guantanamo. It's just absurd. Or staying at a guest house or owning a gun. And, I mean, Afghanistan, everybody's armed with guns. My grandmother has a Kalashnikov, but it doesn't mean she's a terrorist. It's just, it's a different culture, and Americans had a hard time understanding that with, and compounded with the anger and the fear, resulted and leading to relying on locals who were benefiting financially led to all of these mistakes.
My guest is Mavish Rukhsana Khan. Her book, My Guantanamo Diary, The Detainees and the Stories They Told Me, which is published by Public Affairs. The mistreatment of prisoners you describe here is shocking. Dr. Masuvi told you that he'd been beaten, stripped naked, kept in solitary confinement, forced to stay awake for days. Can that type of torture be blamed on a few bad apples, as President Bush has suggested, or did it seem to be part of the culture of the prison?
Well, it seemed to be so pervasive, and the same sort of abuse was recounted by so many detainees. It was documented by the Red Cross and Amnesty International that if it were a few bad apples, then this sort of pattern wouldn't have been so consistent. So I disagree with the fact that, you know, blaming it on the lower-level soldiers.
Well, Vice President Dick Cheney has said that prisoners exaggerate and lie about being tortured. Should you have taken the stories that Dr. Masuvi and other prisoners told you with a grain of salt?
What they told me, I traveled to Afghanistan, and Dr. Ali Shah Masuvi was released, and in fact, he was a pediatrician. He had set up his health clinics, and, you know, I met his family, and it went on like that with detainee after detainee, where we, you know, going back to Afghanistan, collecting exonerating evidence to prove that these individuals were who they were. Their stories did pan out. I eventually grew to My role developed at Guantanamo, and I represent a client there who is a real estate developer, and he was imprisoned by the Taliban, and we were able to show evidence that he was. I mean, newspaper reports showed this locally, and it just, when you are hidden from the world without trial, without being able to present evidence, and not having this system of process, then it's impossible to separate the good from the bad. And to say, you know, were they innocent? Well, you know, what were they innocent of? Because most of these individuals were never charged with any crime.
You went there as a translator. Were you also offering legal advice?
For one client, yes.
And you've said that before going to Guantanamo, you studied therapeutic jurisprudence.
That's correct.
What is
therapeutic jurisprudence? Jurisprudence combines psychology and the law, and it combines the idea of, you know, taking somebody's psychological condition into account and not forcing them to allowing individuals to have control over their legal decisions and involving them as much as possible and respecting them as human beings and taking into account that they have been tortured and issues like that, which definitely come into play at a place like Guantanamo Bay.
So that's also part of the current law school curriculum?
It is. It's a new form of law, actually, that I believe grew out of the University of Chicago, but it's fairly recent within the last 10 years.
One of the most disturbing stories you've included concerns Sami Al-Haj, a Sudanese journalist with Al Jazeera, and his detention attracted the attention of human rights groups. It was the subject of a documentary film called Prisoner 345. He was released in May after your book had already gone to press. Have you heard anything about what he's doing now?
I have heard that he lives in Qatar. He was reunited with his son, Muhammad, after 7 years. His son was just an infant, and he has resumed working for Al Jazeera.
He had been on a hunger strike and was sometimes brutally force-fed for a year before he was released. You've included some of his own descriptions about how he was tortured, and it's really difficult to read. Is there any truth to the rumor that he was treated even more harshly than other prisoners at Guantanamo because he was black?
He alleged that he was, you know, by some of the guards called, you know, racially discriminatory words and not given certain rec time. But it varied a lot because a lot of the detainees were careful to say that some of the guards treated them very well and that it varied, that there was humanity within this you know, very degrading environment. So it varied between the guards. But yes, he did say that.
How many black prisoners are there? Is he a rarity?
I believe he's a minority. I don't know the exact number.
How many times have you visited Guantanamo?
At least 30. I've lost count of the exact number.
And do you stay in Cuba as well when you visit? Or you just go to the base?
We are not allowed to leave the military base. We stay in the combined bachelor quarters, which are kind of like military barrack-type facilities and are escorted by a military guard the entire time and see detainees and leave shortly after.
My guest is Mavish Roxana Khan. Her book, My Guantanamo Diary, The Detainees and the Stories They Told Me, published by Public Affairs. And your description of Guantanamo makes it seem almost surreal. There are two sides of the base, that one for the visitors and one for the prisoners, and they're like night and day.
They are like night and day. Guantanamo is a beautiful place. It's the ocean is green and the weather is perfect, and the people who work there are often immigrants from the Philippines or Jamaica, and they're very nice. And a lot of the guards are nice, too. That was another one of my biases coming in, that they would all be hostile, but they haven't been. And at the other end of the spectrum, you see these prison guard towers, and going in there is like going into a dungeon, because it is, in fact, a dungeon. And going through Camp 6, the walls are this bare cement, and you go through a labyrinth of doors that are unlocked and locked behind you and after you before you get to your meeting room, which is soundproof. And where there's this prisoner shackled to the floor. And I often just felt claustrophobic being there. So it's so, there's such a disconnect between the beauty of where it is, where you feel like, you know, there should be a resort here and not these prison towers.
In fact, you say you could always find steak being cooked on someone's barbecue grill on the visitor side. But how many people, how many visitors wind up seeing the other side?
Other than attorneys and interrogators.
And you were the first Pashto translator, which shocks me a little bit since I'm sure there are many Pashto speakers in the United States, and there are probably any number who were considered loyal in Afghanistan.
I think the background check is so pervasive. It goes back at least 10 years, and a lot of individuals who have lived outside of the country, perhaps it's more difficult for them to receive clearance. But in terms of how long or who are the people who meet the detainees, the military purports to allow journalists to come to the base, but they are given this Mickey Mouse tour of the base where they're shown model cells, and the military tells them how it is, but they have never met a Guantanamo detainee. And one of the prisoners that I met on my first trip after the doctor was this 80-year-old paraplegic, Haji Nusrat, and he, you know, had this long white beard. He couldn't walk because he had suffered from a stroke 15 years before and was brought to Gitmo on a stretcher. And he often asked.
And why did they think he was a terrorist?
They called him an enemy combatant, said he was fighting on the battlefield. And his son was involved with the Karzai regime. There was this weapons disarmament program to collect weapons from the locals and to disarm the, you know, some of the population post Taliban. And he was paid to guard these weapons, and he was accused of having weapons. And it comes to like the psychological concept of confirmation bias, where U.S. soldiers were told that these people were terrorists and, you know, they see weapons, but without investigating, they automatically assume that, you know, he must be al-Qaeda. But he kept asking me, the old man, you know, why aren't journalists allowed to Guantanamo? And why am I being hidden from the world? If I've done something wrong, give me a public trial and charge me with something. And if you can show that I've done something or if my son's done something, then lock me up. But it, you know, goes against the principles upon which our country was founded.
Is he still there?
No, he has been released. And in fact, I was able to visit him in Afghanistan. He was never charged and was released approximately a little over 3 years after he was held there. But one of the first things he asked me was whether I could help him get a visa to come to the United States. And he had, you know, a series of health problems, and he wanted to get an operation and medical care for his paralysis. And I thought he was joking at first because, you know, I was like, why would you want to come to America after everything you've suffered? Why not England or France? And he launched into this tirade about how he, you know, never believed that it was the U.S. maliciously imprisoning him, that they believed in the new democracy, and his son was in fact a senator who worked in the Karzai parliament, but that he just wanted medical treatment. And I thought it spoke volumes for who he was and his forgiveness.
Didn't you also always try to bring food when you visited the detainees? Was bringing food an important gesture?
Yes, it is an important gesture. The Afghans and Middle Eastern cultures are often very hospitable, and food is a huge part of their culture. And a lot of the book describes this journey of heritage and I learned a lot about my heritage from these individuals, and I tried to give them a semblance of their culture and, you know, would bring them Starbucks chai because it was the closest thing to the type of tea they bring home, they drink back home. Or
what did you bring to the Haji Nusrat, the paralyzed man?
I brought him, it was our first meeting, and so, I mean, he told me what his favorite foods were, and so I had planned on bringing that in the second meeting, but the first one, it was, you know, pistachios and chai and food that was available on the base, and it was my first time there, so I didn't know that I could actually cook on the base, which I later began to do, like lamb and rice and stuff like that, but
this is also part of Afghan tradition, isn't it, to bring a gift?
Bring at least like for your guests, just to treat them as hospitably as possible. And I would have brought him more than food, but they don't allow us to leave those items with the prisoners.
You said your favorite detainee was a young man named Taj Mohammed. Didn't he tell you that he'd been a goat herder before he was arrested?
Yes. Taj was my favorite, not because of anything more than the fact that he was easy to speak to. He wasn't old, and I didn't feel sorry for him as much. He was my age, and the doctor was so polite. And Taj was just loaded with personality, and, you know, he wanted me to translate English cuss words for him and just made me laugh a lot. And it was an easy dynamic to be around him because Guantanamo is so intense emotionally, and these prisoners and what they've suffered, that being around somebody like, you know, lighthearted Taj Mohammed, who used humor and, you know, wanted to learn English swear words, was an easier dynamic.
Is he still being held in Guantanamo?
No, he has been released, never charged.
So most of the people you translated for have been released?
A good chunk of them have been. Guantanamo at its peak has had about 800 individuals. There's about 270-something left. And some of the individuals that I have met continue to be there. There is a school teacher, and there are, you know, guards, people who had different occupations are still at Guantanamo.
Can I assume that most of them really are dangerous?
I wouldn't assume that. They've never been charged with anything of any threat to the United States or their home countries. And, you know, the assumption that I made initially going in there was that they must have done something to be there. And I found that I was biased by believing everything I'd heard by the administration and by the media. And
Well, some of them must be guilty.
Some of them, definitely. Without a doubt, I do believe that Guantanamo holds dangerous individuals. I haven't met any of them, but, you know, I can speak of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, 9/11 mastermind. He's there, and though he was brought on Guantanamo's fifth anniversary, I do believe that there are likely good and bad people all swept together, and it's hard to tell who's who without a trial, without transparency, and without giving them a shot at proving their innocence. And, you know, you can let bad people go and keep good ones in without that. And it's a flawed system.
Well, I get the feeling that you wrote this book in part to attach names, faces, and stories to the numbers that many of the Guantanamo prisoners have been reduced to.
That's correct. The prisoners have been reduced to numbers. They're stripped of their names and their individualities. And at Bagram Air Base, before they come, all of that happens. And a serial number is for an inanimate object. It is for things that are all alike. And when you give something a name, whether it's an animal or a person, it makes it individual and unique. And what happened to the Guantanamo detainees is they were stripped of their names, their individualities. They had their beards, their hair, their facial hair all shaved. They were dressed alike, and they were numbered. And meeting them, I understood why they are hidden from the world and why they're serial numbered, because it's easier to abuse something called 1154. But when you know that he's a pediatrician, or 1009, when you know he's his grandfather, and when you realize they're more like you than they are different, and understand them as individuals. And that's what this book is about, because there were, you know, so many stories and interfaith dialogue between attorneys and their clients, and forgiveness and laughter and friendship that was built between lawyers and their clients. And it's a story that transcends Guantanamo.
Well, you said that when you first went there, you dressed modestly because you didn't know how they would react to a young woman, an attractive young woman, showing up.
Thank you.
What happened later? Were you able to relax with them, or did you find that you had to, on some level, maintain that formality?
Well, there was always this cultural dynamic for me, because I am American, and yet I do have these ties to my ethnicity and heritage. And
do you have an American accent when you speak Pashto?
Yes, I speak Pashto with an American accent, and a lot of them thought it was cute, but I went in trying to respect where they came from, and that's why I covered my hair. And some of them were smart, and they knew that, you know, some of them asked me, you know, do you wear that in America? Are you doing this for us? And I tried to be as truthful as I could, and I told them that, you know, I didn't, and explained why. And a lot of them were fine with it. And but always when I met somebody initially, I always covered. And I did it consistently throughout just because it was, you know, I started doing it that way. But it was definitely a journey of heritage for me, learning so much about where I came from through these men and our back and forth ideas of East and West. And I think some of the attorneys found that also.
You've been published in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post. You have this book, The Guantanamo Diary. Are you going back to law? Are you going to become a writer full time?
Well, I feel like once you're a writer, you're always a writer. And I've sort of, you know, if there's a topic that I wish or hope to share with individual or the public, then I will continue writing. But I do hope to practice.
Mavish Rukhsana Khan, her book, My Guantanamo Diary, The Detainees and the Stories They Told Me, published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.